So then, good evening, and I'd like to hear a little bit from you about how it was to do the practice this last week at home, and any questions you might have about the practice of initial application of attention, sustained application, tracking your experience and how things change as you're present for it. And how was it? Is it that you're very shy, extremely shy? You think that your experience doesn't count, or you have nothing to report, or just so phenomenal that you're embarrassed to mention it in front of all the all your friends here?
Okay. It was terrible. I go to the focus and breath or whatever. Couldn't stay on it for more than 2 seconds. And my mind is off, and then I realize, of course it's off. I mean, this is what goes on all the time in my meditation. So it's off. So I said, oops, okay, come back. 2 seconds later,
there I am.
This would go on the whole
time. So your experience was the same as it would be normally in meditation.
Yes.
So so you have the ability to have that initial application of attention, of
yes,
putting it on the breath. But did you experiment with doing so a little bit more energetically, or with more?
With what?
A little bit more energetically than usual, or more dedication,
yeah,
or resolve?
I tried changing the focus, mm-hmm, to the pain in my knee. Focused on that, uh-huh, for a while, until that got so bad,
uh-huh,
that I had to correct, do something,
uh-huh,
to correct it. And then I tried to find a different focus. But it was the same experience. I just, you know, after a few seconds, I realized I'm out in the ether.
Uh-huh.
So I was thinking this is no different than normal.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
I get very warm very soon after I start. And so I stayed with it, and I kind of felt the kind of prickliness, or the kind of almost bursting through the skin. And I found that I could almost control it for a little while, make it even more intense. I was going to see if I could break into a sweat or not. And then it disappeared. And then it just went away.
Once, or is it a pattern that you?
I usually only do that once.
So one of the things you're tracking then is this heat and how you experience the heat in your body. And at some point it passes away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Yeah.
I had this experience where it seems like when I first started meditating, my thoughts were louder. And now it seems like it's almost like they're sneaking up on me. They're really quiet. But it's like I know I'm going off on these thoughts.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how to describe it much better than that. That's almost like it's going somewhere between consciousness and kind of dreamy.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, yeah.
It's not as loud of chatter, but it's still like,
well, I am. It's almost as if we have kind of layers in the psyche. And so as we get more calm, more relaxed, more concentrated, some of the surface chatter, surface conversations we have in the mind quiet down, and then the more subtle stuff can kind of reveal itself or have a chance. And on one hand, it can be very interesting sometimes because it's almost like dreamlike states or images or words or whatever might happen. Sometimes it reveals some things about ourselves that we wouldn't otherwise know, kind of underneath, you know, what makes us tick. And sometimes it's very, very alluring to be there. It's very seductive to kind of go into that realm. It's very comforting. And so it's kind of a trap for meditators. But it also points to the fact that the mind is very tricky and has the ability to keep you from really staying on track with the meditation. And so when meditation gets more subtle, because you're more concentrated and calm, you have to actually have bring in an appropriate amount of vigilance or alertness to balance that so that the mind doesn't keep drifting off. into those kinds of subtle, more subtle kind of thoughts.
I think that was a lot of my experience, was noticing the subtle thoughts. I tried to be more of a reporter, you know, standing, not try to tell the story, although I thought that was very hard to do when I first started writing. It was hard not to feel so personal about it.
Uh-huh.
Keep it as a report. But I think it was really good because, like, at one time, I kind of felt the wisdom of leaving the world behind, because I had had sort of a hard emotional encounter the day before, and I could feel it sort of wanting to call to me and just seemed like even though I was calling, that it was okay to not go there, because if I don't mean not to notice it,
mm-hmm.
I could notice it and right. could feel it, but the little stories, that's what it is, I guess all of a sudden I noticed that as soon as I start saying a little story, even about a realization, it goes off.
It goes off.
It goes off into a bigger story, and then pretty soon I'm in a pretty big journey.
One of the decisions we need to make is where in our life do we want to live? And a lot of people live what I call sometimes the world of aboutness. They live in the world of thoughts about things. And the world of aboutness, thoughts about things, is not the thing itself. And so we're actually removed. You're kind of living in kind of a virtual reality. And so learning how to kind of, in a healthy way, wise way, not be caught up in the story makings of the mind, all the about stories, and actually seeing things directly as they actually are in the moment, is you know, one of the key elements of deepening Vipassana practice. And you there's plenty of time later to do the stories. Yes.
What's an insight?
An insight. Here in the West, many of us think of psychological insight as being many people consider equated with some kind of insight into your personality, kind of your biography, kind of what makes you tick, kind of psychological insight. What it means in the insight meditation tradition, it means that when you can actually have your mindfulness be connect deeply enough, in a sustained enough fashion, to penetrate the what's called the kind of true nature or the inherent nature of your experience. And so you see the universal characteristics of your experience, not that which is personal. Mm-hmm. That seeing the universal characteristics of your experience is what we call insight with a capital I. And there's three insights you can have. The primary one, especially for Vipassana, is being able to discern impermanence, to really see deeply into the nature of impermanence as a universal characteristic of experience. And the second is not self, to have deep insight that whatever experience you're having, that experience doesn't qualify as a self.
My next question is, if you experience insight, like, are you also watching your breath at the same time?
It can be. You can have it.
I mean, what I'm saying is, it would seem. I found myself really finding a lot of pleasure in not really my thinking, but just meditating, just hanging out.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't. And it's business of like counting my breath or being aware of it just seemed almost like superficial. I could either do that or I could just kind of like hang out. And it wasn't really thinking, but it was just kind of like hanging out. And I had a little thought and everything. And this little hanging out place where I was having my little thoughts was much more pleasurable. And that's what I got out of this exercise, is how much pleasure I had from just sitting.
From your sitting?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And So pleasure is expected as meditation deepens. a lot of pleasure will come as part of the path. Pleasure can also enjoy and happiness and rapture and a lot of wonderful experiences can happen, but they can also be traps for a meditator. And so a meditator can get stuck there, get attached to those, and think that's what meditation is about, and just hang out there, kind of become complacent or just drift there, not really continue making the wise effort that it takes to have the concentration, the mindfulness deepen even further. It's kind of like, you know, if you're, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but if you're trying to get up to the, you know, 10th floor of a building, and you make it to the second floor, and that's where the movie theater is, you know, so you decide just to stay there and watch the endless movies they have, but rather than, you know, taking the stairwells one flight up or, you know, all the way up.
I had some difficulty with that first part of the exercise, which was paying attention to the acquisition of whatever you were paying attention to.
You mean pay attention to the way in which you connected to it?
Right. Uh-huh. And I think that's because for some time, whatever I'm going to meditate on, the focus of my meditation, it's a preference, or I've trained myself to kind of drift into it, to let it appear with extreme ease.
Mm-hmm.
It's like floating in a lake and you bump into the log or something.
Yeah.
And the instruction to pay any attention to that kind of unsettled me a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I did find that once I sort of noted that I was unsettled by that and then kind of let that whole part of it go, that I was able to stay with things for incredible lengths of time. I mean, over the course of 45 minutes, I might get lost 4 times, 5 times.
Great, great. So you're able to give a little bit more emphasis on the sustaining power of attention.
And that generated something I've actually been feeling since I started the course, and maybe a little bit before that. Sort of, is that all there is kind of doubt. I've always had a very strong ability to my concentration comes to me very easily. I don't know if it's a natural phenomenon or fact that I've trained myself in various disciplines over the years to be very concentrated. So concentration is kind of an easy thing. And sitting there watching my breath very closely. I watch my breath for a while, and then I can actually watch my heartbeat in conjunction with the breath and get, you know, really delicate feelings of that whole thing. So it seems like there ought to be somewhere to go from there.
You said a lot, so I'm not quite sure what strand to pick up from. The way the Vipassana practice unfolds is by sustaining the attention very carefully on your particular experiences as it's happening, and then tracking or seeing into its nature. So when you sustain the attention there and see it for a while, kind of penetrate it, a number of things can happen. One is that you might see that it begins to change. You might see how it changes. It might morph into something else, or you might see it, or it might fade away and disappear, or you might see that it's kind of oscillating or vibrating or flashing in and out of existence, kind of thing. There's a number of ways in which, you know, it doesn't remain a solid thing, but you actually start seeing its changing nature. But seeing its changing nature requires is a kind of paradox. The greater stillness you have of the mind, the greater the greater you can have insight you can have into the impermanence of your experience. The more agitated the mind is, the more things seem to be permanent. So where it goes is that it goes to deeper and deeper insight. It goes to deeper and deeper penetration of the experience you have. And as you do that, the concentration deepens, and that's one of the wonderful aspects of the practice. But not just the concentration, but also the kind of mindfulness, the way in which you experience the object of awareness changes also. So it isn't just simply that our experience is given, you know, always it's always going to be the same. But as the practice deepens, how we experience our experience, how we experience the object of awareness, begins to change also. So that's why an important part of classic Vipassana practice is paying more and more careful attention to the objects of awareness. You know, what is this? And never settling for anything. Always, what is this? Get closer. Does that make sense? So with the breathing, for example, you probably want to kind of. I think it's very, very beautiful what you described. How you get more and more into the subtleties of the experience there. And then can you get more subtle? Can you pick a very particular area of that subtlety and just really get into it and kind of get into that, you know, the vibration of it, the subtlety arising and passing of it, and kind of rest and kind of merge your attention, your awareness into that experience closer, kind of get into it. Does that make sense?
It makes sense logically. There's a point beyond which ideas.
Right. Right. So.
Have to be assimilated in a different way.
Uh-huh. Okay. So one of the ways to continue with this, if you had an interview, for example, is you would describe in the interview the best of your ability, the cutting edge of your meditation practice, the deepest state of concentration you get in your meditation, and then describe what your experience is there, and in particular how you experience the objects of awareness. So if you're doing the breath, how you experience that breath.
I had another experience that I like to comment on. I'm on call all, you know, practically all the time. So the company phone rings, I have to answer. And yesterday or the day before, I was sitting, the phone rang. And it happened to be right there. So I simply reached over, picked it up, and answered the phone. And I had a conversation with someone, a computer problem that was going on in any case. I noticed through the entire course of the phone call that I had automatically shifted my focus of concentration to the conversation, listening to what the person was saying, being aware of what I was saying, watching my thoughts, trying to solve the problem. It was actually quite an amazing experience. And then I hung up the phone and I put it down and I closed my eyes again.
Nice.
It was actually a kind of strange experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think I may not have understood the exercise. I was distinguishing always between a concentration meditation exercise, like a loving kindness, and really focusing on a loving kindness or my breath, as opposed to what I was doing, which sounds like I was doing something wrong, was to still my mind and then let something arise. Now that was just chatter and talk or planning or something and go back to my breath. But if a sensation like a heat or something like that, then I would make that my awareness. And then I would explore that, it would disappear, and then something else would come. And I would keep doing that through the 45 minutes of meditation.
Sounds great. Yeah, it sounds great, yeah. So the idea is to was to experiment with these two qualities, how you initially connect to the experience, to whatever your object is, And there are different ways to do that. I mean, so Bill talks about kind of just floating to the object, kind of. So some people pounce on the object of awareness. They can jump on it, you know, or they attack it or something. And it's very. I think it's very nice to do it, kind of just float. But even so, floating to the object, however you get to the object, and then can you really, at some point, there's a kind of a choice. Okay, this is where I'm going to put my attention. I'm going to pay attention to this heat. And so that initial choice, that initial kind of connection, how is that? Is it firm? Is it direct? Is it committed? Or is it kind of complacent, kind of reluctant? And the idea is to really be there fully for it. Just connect to it, you know, like you're really there for that experience. Not to be kind of easygoing about it. I mean, we're supposed to be very accepting in Vipassana, very relaxed about what's there. But you also want to kind of clearly let the observing or the knowing clearly kind of be there for that thing. So kind of lock in on it, in a sense. And then once you're kind of locked in or stabilize yourself in that, then sustain that attention over time and track what happens to it. And that's what you did.
Yeah, and then what I would find is that that it was all impermanent.
Yeah.
And pretty soon there was no sensation of heat.
Great.
So I would let go of that, and then something else would come.
Perfect.
Is that what you want?
That's great. That's great practice. Yes?
I was experimenting with sustaining attention for longer time.
Yeah.
And one of the objects was sound. And so for a while I was looking at that, and I wasn't actually sure whether it was an inner sound or an outer sound. I was watching it for a while, and then I realized that there was a strong expectation that I'd be curious and excited about the investigation. I mean, what happened was, I lost interest. So, there was conflict that arose. Like, I should be interested. I should want to continue this exploration. So I guess my question is, I ended up making the object the disinterest or the conflict.
Perfect.
So switching more to the mind state. So I found that then that happened several times. there was this conflict that I really should be more, I'm not a very curious person, I should be more curious and be able to investigate, penetrate more deeply. And then ended up every time going back to investigating the expectation of the mind state. Is that?
Yeah, I didn't give a great detail instructions, but there's so many ways of doing mindfulness practice, but that certainly it's one of the ways is to I think it's a very very wise way is if you're with some object, and what becomes more prominent in your experience is the way in which you're relating to the practice at that moment, the impatience or the eagerness or whatever it might be, then you let go of the object and make that mental state the object of attention. So this is, you know, so you're welcome to have your attention move around wherever it's appropriate. But the idea was there's just two qualities of attention. There's the initial application and there's a sustaining it. But sustaining it doesn't mean that you then are fixated, you know, like, you know, on one thing. Yeah, what we practice a form of serial monogamy in Vipassana. So whatever's there, you can sustain your attention there until something happens that makes something else more appropriate to pay attention to. So either because that first thing disappears, or something else becomes louder, or seems more to be kind of in the forefront. And that's what you were doing, it sounds like. You were there, and at some point you felt the impatience or the doubt or whatever, and you turned and faced that. What you might need to do is to look a little bit at what you think of as being interest and curiosity. And it might be, it's possible that you have some, you know, either some reluctance at that department, or maybe it's not your natural tendency or something. But it could also be that you have some reluctance.
Oh,
okay. Or it could be that it's just not your natural tendency to do that. But it could be that that you have a little bit maybe too analytical idea of what investigation is. And you're holding it a little bit too complicated in your mind what investigation means. And the kind of what it means in the mind to be curious and engaged in that kind of way, like a scientist or something. And maybe there's a way of being sustaining the attention over time, being attentive, what is this experience? that is actually much more, much simpler than how you're holding it so far. Something that's sustainable over time. Because, you know,
Yeah. Hey, but another comment about that is that what do you do with thoughts in an exercise like this? So a thought arises and you're focusing it on paying, you know, a mindfulness of your thoughts. And so a thought arises and you sort of, but you're really let many thoughts arise. And is that an appropriate exercise to do in this case?
I'm not quite following you. Mindfulness can be practiced to any experience at all. So
in this particular exercise, where you're trying to concentrate and keep awareness of attention.
Right.
So if your mind is chattering, you have a lot of thoughts. You just let thoughts come.
Uh-huh.
Is that appropriate or not? Or is it?
It can be, but it can be appropriate. But if you're looking at thoughts, I mean, sometimes you can just track the thoughts as they're going on. But if you're kind of looking at the thinking process head on, really connecting to it and exploring it and feeling it, what it's like in the body, feeling, you know, different ways in which I talk about the practice, the thinking will quiet down pretty quickly. We think through time, over time, because we're engaged in the thinking process. If we're no longer fueling the thinking process, the thinking process, the thoughts will settle away pretty quickly. You know, so you probably heard me say this. I distinguish between thoughting and thinking. You know, and thoughting is a natural thing the mind does, but our engagement with the thinking, with the thoughts, the thinking, that only comes from our engagement, from fueling it. So part of the skill of learning vipassana of thinking is to learn how to look at it, connect to it clearly, so that in the connecting with it clearly, you at the same time you disengage yourself from the interest, the fascination, the fueling of the thinking process itself. And you know, and sometimes there's a lot of momentum in our thoughts. Sometimes there's very powerful momentum of thinking going on. So you can, for example, then connect to, if it's that powerful, and one has a life of its own in a sense, is maybe then connect to the physicality of that experience. You know, so you can feel a tension or tightness or the vibration or something that's going on in the body. And feel that for a long time. Just feel the physicality of the thinking process. Learning how to work with thoughts is a very important part of mindfulness, as many of you know. I mean, thoughts, getting caught up in our thoughts is a big problem, you know, because it's one of the hindrances that gets us in the way of sustaining an ongoing, constant kind of flow of mindfulness. I don't know. It was kind of muddled, my response, I think, but set.
Apropos of that, after a week before feeling like I was just couldn't concentrate at all, after that last class, I went back and it really all worked. And I felt really a lot of body awareness, and it became so strong that it sort of made the thoughts seem very inconsequential, and it was like listening to a radio in somebody else's house, just sort of, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't even getting into those thoughts, because I kind of felt the force of gravity connecting me, and just sort of like a iron filing with, you put the magnet underneath and it straightens up.
Yeah. Yeah, when the power of mindfulness gets strong, then, as you said, the thoughts can just kind of recede in the background. Thinking still be going on, but we're not so connected, we're not so interested in them. They pale in significance to the tremendous appeal of mindfulness of the body or the meditative feelings coming up or whatever we're concentrating on.
And I found that I really liked that feeling. Then I didn't want to go right after.
Yes.
From what you said before when we were talking to Ken about thoughts, my question is, what I normally do is when I realize I'm thinking, is just drop it and come back to my breath.
Right.
That's the focus. But now I'm getting the idea maybe it would be okay to take a look at what I was thinking and inquire into what was I thinking, not get caught in the story of it, but see if there's any physical response that was going on while I was thinking, whatever it was.
Right.
And maybe why did that come up, or however the investigation would take me. Is that, so that becomes the focus.
Yeah, yes. What you might want to do is to get one of the tapes of my class, and when I do the intro class, there's a whole class that, on mindfulness of thinking. Oh. And on that day, I talk a lot about how to work with thoughts.
Oh.
And you might want to get that tape and hear about these kinds of things. So then I'd like to ask you further. So I don't know how it was then. I heard a kind of mixed review about this thing about the initial and sustained application of attention. But what about the thing of putting aside the concept of your experience, your ideas, your stories, and being there more for the direct experience itself and tracking what's happening in the direct experience. Is that something that made sense for you? Is that something that was interesting and helpful? And anything you'd like to say about that? No? Myrna?
I guess I was very interested in your suggesting we should be more active during this class because I hadn't been. And so I did this. I figured that energy and concentration were the two faculties that I was weak in. So I decided, all right, the spine gives me energy if I hold it up, and that's not really letting go. So I just decided to be active, and on the in-breath, I would give myself energy by breathing in more deeply than usual, which you suggested to me, and straightening the spine. And so I would think energy on the inhalation, and then I would think concentration on the exhalation, because I tried to just concentrate, and that's not a very long time, so I knew I could do it. I knew my thoughts would have run in just the exhalation. It was a slow exhalation because the inhalation was extra big.
Yeah.
So then it was kind of like a triangle, because it would go up with energy on the inhalation, and then it would go down as a slow concentration, just mindful of the concentration or something. And then in the little pause, I thought, I'll sweep the body mind and see if there's a thought or feeling that's really frustrated because I wasn't thinking about them on the inhalation and exhalation. So I just gave a little sweep to see if there was some frustrated thing, and there never was. It was really the activity, I think, damped down the thoughts.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of worked. And then after 3 or 4 minutes, one would come and I'd get hooked into it and lost. And so I decided, all right, I'm going to open my eyes and look at the timer as it counts down. And I'll put, if it started at 45, then I'll put like 43, just right down on the pad, 43, and then like pumpkin pie. Because that's what I was thinking about. Should we have pumpkin or apple pie next week? So I'll just, you know, I wanted to see if my stray thoughts were really important.
Yeah.
And so the first time I did it, I had 17, and they were all over the place. And today I had 12, and I noticed that they just jumped everywhere, and they weren't at all worth straying to. It was nothing really good. I mean, it was interesting to see that my mind was just not having, I think I must have been just bored of the repetition. So I kind of did a lot of things actively.
Uh-huh. Great. I love it. That's great.
But it didn't feel like being mindful of what is.
Uh-huh. Right.
At all.
Right. So one of the interesting interplays or kind of in Vipassana meditation is the balance between letting things be as they are, which is so central to the whole practice here, versus having some being actively engaged in some way to help that process along. And some people feel that we're not allowed to do anything except just simply see how things are. But then if you ask them, they say, well, actually, you know, I do sit up straight, you know, I do close my eyes, I do try to follow my breath. There are some things that the person does. They don't just simply sit in choiceless awareness. And some people are very technique-oriented, very engaged and very involved, and, you know, adjusting a lot, and adjust their breath, they adjust their mind states, they adjust you know, the posture, they adjust a lot of different things to kind of optimize exactly how, you know, some way to support the practice itself and kind of deepen the concentration and the mindfulness. And so how do we negotiate, you know, this range of possibilities from being able to be very manipulative and versus, you know, completely, you know, just receptive and just seeing and not trying to change anything at all. And what I find is that in different circumstances, different things are called upon, called for. And that we don't have to see those two as being exclusive of each other. They both can happen at the same time. So the question can be, what can I do to help make it easier for me to see clearly what my experience is right now? And sometimes having more energy is helpful. So we get up and we do a walking meditation, and that brings the energy, and so we come back to sit. You know, we can have more energy, we can see more clearly. Sometimes we see that you know, I'm not going to be able to see very clearly what goes on here if I keep drifting off my thoughts all this time. So I need to have more concentration. So I think what I'll do is I'll work for 5-10 minutes on concentration. And so the mind is more stabilized, and then I can start seeing things as they are and be more accepting of them and not, you know, try to change things. So you know, it's not either or. But mindfulness meditation is a... There's many, many... Because our mind is so complex. There's so many different factors of our mind that there's so many different avenues and approaches a person can take. There's probably as many different vipassana techniques, in a sense, approaches, as there are people in the world. And, you know, there's so many different ways. And then you hear there's so many different ways, and then it's exhausting. And then you spend all your time wondering, you know, maybe I haven't found the right way, or should I try this? No, I'll try this. I'll try this. And 30 seconds goes by, no, I think I should try this, and try something else, and then we get caught up. And so you have to be discerning enough to know that you're not going to deepen your practice by jumping around doing a lot of different practices. But somehow having some wise relationship to the balance and the appropriate way of knowing when to be receptive and when to just see things as they are without trying to change anything, and when it's appropriate to change something about what's going on, is part of the art of meditation practice. And what will happen is that you'll, as I think said last week, it's kind of you find your way through trial and error. And as you find your way through trial and error, you will make mistakes. You find, so, oh, looks to me like I was trying too much there. I was paying too much effort, or I switched practices too quickly, or, you know, I was trying to, you know, I was trying to get more concentrated, but that's not really what was called for. What was called for was to be more mindful of the distracted mind, to look at this distracted mind more clearly. And so we find our way through a little bit through our mistakes. Now, one of the things we need to be discerning about is that some people have such active and hyperactive minds that the most wisest thing to do for a long time, for years, is a very allowing meditation practice that simply sees things as they are without trying to change anything at all in their experience until they've weaned themselves of the habit of judgmentally or critically getting in there and kind of, you know, manipulating willfully their experience. And then some people, you know, and then after some years of doing that kind of practice and having some stability and that kind of allowing and acceptance, then maybe they can find some way to, okay, let me see if, can I do anything? Can I do some more active now in my meditation practice to take it to a new level? And then they can experiment with that. There's a huge repertoire of tools available to you when you do Vipassana practice. And I regret that to some degree, because it makes it, you know, so many different choices and questions and all that. And sometimes it's a great relief to be given instructions that are very, very simple and constant. Anyway, that's... I don't know where we're at, but... you know, the different exercises I've given you here for this class, you know, you can think of them as exercises to highlight different aspects of your meditation experience, and so you can see more clearly what's going on. And then trusting that as you see more clearly what's going on, then you can stop doing the exercise, but you'll be more sensitive to how these things play themselves out. And being sensitive, a tremendous amount of meditation practice does unfold by simply seeing clearly what's going on. But there's often big domains of our experience, our inner experience, which we kind of keep off stage. we don't really notice. We don't really, because we haven't been trained or taught to look at it. And so by doing these exercises, for example, which are a little bit intentional, a little bit agitating compared to maybe your regular meditation for some of you, it might, you know, you do it for a week and then you stop. And then maybe you're more sensitive to notice how these things operate. Oh, you notice, oh, when I meditate, I can connect to my experience very nicely, but then I don't actually sustain that anymore. I just kind of, then I let the mind drift. And to see that is very, very helpful. And you might decide to do something about that, you might decide to do nothing, but now you're mindful of something you weren't mindful of before. And you're more sensitive to catch that. And so there's going to be a greater continuity of mindfulness in the practices as you go along. Does that make sense what I said to you? So it's greater familiarity with something. And so any one of these exercises, these last 3 weeks, you could spend a few months on just one of these exercises. You know, just, you know, if any of them seemed appealing to you, to spend, you know, a couple of months or a month or however long, and, you know, keep the journal or whatever. Have the, like the first week we had the checklist. You know, just do that for a few months. And one of the shortcomings of a class like this is that we jumped around so much, you know, from 1 week to the next, you know, so many different things. And maybe it was too fast. But I was trying to, you know, maybe it was too fast to go that fast, you know, to introduce so many different concepts in such a short time. What do you think? No? Yes?
Well, I just think it's very helpful just to point out all the, you know, that there are all these different tools, because that's been one of my issues.
Yeah.
I'm going to get caught in indecisiveness, and should be loving kindness, or should I focus on my breath, or minutes,
right.
You know, or whatever, and then just get caught up in
what to do.
What the heck am I supposed to be doing here?
So that's great. So sooner or later you'll notice that that's a problem. Then you have to be discerning about deciding what to do about it. And then maybe you just decide, well, this is not going to work at all. I think what I need to do is to have some kind of commitment for some period of time with some practice. How do I decide which practice? I'll do my best guess, or I'll ask a teacher for help or something. It doesn't really matter what just choose something. And then hang in there and develop some stability in that practice. And then later you could switch. And so that's an example where you would learn from your experience. You learn that it's not useful to jump around, so now you have to make a decision to stay, you know, more focused on one particular tool. Okay. So let's meditate. I'll do some guided meditation. And if you want to stand for a minute, you're welcome to do that, a few seconds. So then take a few moments in whatever way is your way of settling into the practice here, to the meditation, getting as settled, as concentrated, as present as you can in a relaxed way. So then as you're sitting here for the next while, commit yourself to not moving at all. Not moving, not even an eyeball, not even your lips or your tongue, your hands. No intentional moving whatsoever, not for any itch, not for anything. But then when the urge arises to move, bring careful attention to that urge, to the intention to move. Feel the physical energy of the urge, the impulse. Feel the words, the images in the mind connected to desire and wanting to move. And don't move. Just kind of look at the desire, the urge to move head on. Let it pass or let go of it. And then as you're doing the Vipassana practice, either doing mindfulness of breathing or doing it in some other way, perhaps you just do mindfulness of the breathing for now. Being mindful of your breath. And if your mind is subtle enough, if you're sitting quietly enough, then notice any impulse or intention to move the mind, to move the attention, to change a mental state, to do something with your mind, to direct the attention someplace else, to go and grab onto some kind of thought. There can be impulses, urges, intentions to move the mind as much as to move the body. And don't initially move your mind for anything. Just keep it on the breath. And then feel that urge. Be mindful of it. Note it. See it. if you notice your mind's, your head drooping because you're sleepy, let it be that way. Notice the intention that might arise to straighten it out. If you have a strong desire to move, and you've been with the desire, the intention for some time, then you're welcome to move after a while. But hang in there first and notice the intention. Notice what it's like to have a desire for something about your meditation, perhaps. Notice the qualities of your intention. What's the motivation behind any intention you might have? And then in a few seconds, I'm going to ring the bell to end the sitting. And when you hear the bell, don't open your eyes automatically. Wait to open your eyes until you feel very clearly the urge or the intention, the desire to open your eyes. And then, even when you feel it clearly, don't open your eyes right away, but hang out and feel what that urge or intention to open the eyes feels like. Once you've opened your eyes and you're ready to move some part of your body to adjust your posture, whatever, at the end of the sitting, do the same thing with that. Don't be in a hurry to move your body or to adjust your legs, but stay in the posture you're in until you can feel clearly some urge or intention, desire to move your body. And even when you can feel it clearly, don't move then. Just hang out a little bit, feeling it and getting to know it. So we'll take our time with this. So I'll ring the bell and then maybe we'll give ourselves 2-3 minutes just to do this exercise. And then at the end of that exercise, I'll ring a bell a second time when we get ready to start talking about it. So on a longer Vipassana retreat, for example, on a 10-day retreat, it might be on the seventh day or so that instructions are given to include mindfulness of intentions. The reasons why we wait so long with that level of instructions is that you need to have a mind which is quite settled and mindful and concentrated to really catch the nuances of intentions. And also mind which is not going to be caught up in story making around intentions and can kind of get analytical about it. And what some people find is that halfway through the retreat or some point well into the retreat, they can add a whole different dimension of depth to their practice, to start paying attention to the intentions that as they're operating. It can be a completely fascinating study of mindfulness to include that. Intentions are operating all the time. Prior to just about any movement of the body or the mind, there's often an intention, an impulse, an urge, a desire. And most of the time in our lives, a lot of this goes unnoticed. We always move, you know. The impulse, the intention is kind of, it's almost indistinguishable from the actual action that we do. But to pay attention to the intention, certainly, because it's something that's happening all the time anyway, it's one more thing to keep on the stage. As mindfulness, you have to get more and more alert and more present to notice the intention. Is very helpful for the building up of the momentum of mindfulness. It also helps with the subtlety of mindfulness, where you're really beginning to track more subtlety what goes on moment by moment. And as you watch the subtlety of what's going on moment by moment, you come to also a greater level of choice then about what you do with your mind. Do you follow through on some of these impulses to move, for example? And, I mean, many of us, you know, we sit and meditate and then we don't notice that we're moving our hand to do an itch until, you know, we're halfway through, until we touch the place. Or, you know, we slump a little bit. And we don't really notice the intention to straighten up. But, you know, we notice we're straightening up, you know, or something. The movement happens. Or you're sitting here and you feel an itch, for example. And the mind has been focusing on the breath. And now you want to bring your attention to the itch or the pain or the pleasant sensations, whatever it might be. And there's an intention that arises to make that transition, to move there. Or there might be a feeling that, I'm not very concentrated today. I think I need to kind of bear down, be more attentive on the breath here. And so there's an intention to do that. And then maybe the person does that, for better or worse. But there's an intention that arises, even it affects the movements of the mind, the activity of the mind, what the mind chooses to do or not to do. So it can be very helpful to start noticing all this. It's also very helpful to hold the body still. And one of the ways to cultivate a continuity of attention, greater stability in the practice, is to begin cultivating holding your body still. It's very, very strongly encouraged. Not as a, you know, grueling activity. You're welcome to move if you need to. But there's a lot of movement that people can do that's semi-conscious and not really necessary. And every time we move the body somewhat semi-consciously with intentions we're not clear about, we're also moving the mind. It kind of keeps the mind agitated, usually. And a lot of people find that their sitting gets a lot deeper and more stable, more calmer, if they can hold their body still. If you do that, one of the things you will notice, though, is sometimes, sooner or later, you'll notice maybe even a battle between wanting to move and your commitment not to move. And that wanting to move is the intention, the urge to move. And to see that clearly for what it is fascinating. One of the reasons it's fascinating is then we can start studying or becoming aware of what motivates that intention. So, say for example, you're sitting, and after a while you feel like the sitting's not going so well. You're not so concentrated today. And so you decide, well, I think I'll get up and watch television or something, right? Go to the refrigerator or read a book or something or do something. So you feel the intention is to break the meditation and do something else. But then if you really stay there and look at that intention, you might find what is motivating that intention. It might be that there's aversion to the state you're in, aversion to the discomfort of it. It might be that there's a sense of feeling of laziness. Oh, this is too much work. I don't think I want to apply myself so much today. And actually, the intention to get up, break the meditation, might come out of laziness. Or it might be out of wisdom. It might say, oh, this is not very useful for for me to do this, to practice this way. I'm developing bad habits by practicing this way. I think I'll take a break and come back later when I'm not in this habits, you know. And so it can be a wise reason to end the sitting. So by being still enough to look at the intention, sometimes then we can start noticing what motivates the intention, what's feeding into that intention. And there's many different mind states, many different that might feed into that intention. There might be mind states of greed, hate, and delusion. There might be mind states of wisdom and generosity and love, and different things that might feed into it. So, what was your experience sitting here? Paying attention to intention, yeah.
I had a very bad experience because I think I took you literally when you said, don't move. I immediately, like, when I closed my eyes, I realized if I don't move, I can't breathe.
Oh. I'm glad you're still here.
Uh-huh. And then I felt tears coming down my face. I'm like, God, I can't. That's moving too. My heart started beating.
Oh, I see. Hard,
and my palms were sweating. So I, obviously I had to breathe a little.
Oh, I see.
And then I spent the rest of the time trying to figure out what your intention was. Clearly it wasn't what I was doing. So I became very aware of all the completely involuntary parts of
uh-huh. Fascinating. Well, fascinating. I mean, that's interesting, I mean, to do that. So interesting, the whole thing, your experience. I apologize if I wasn't so clear on on the instructions. I guess I was just kind of assuming that, you know, the idea was you're just going to be as you normally would, breathe normally, and you know, and let your heart beat away freely, but just you know, sometimes people are sitting and meditating and they go like this, or they go like this, you know, very very small movements, you know, that's kind of what I meant. Yes.
I often get this incredible urge to swallow, and I'm still not sure if I'm actually collecting saliva, but I always find that's the big problem. What to do with the saliva? Just let it sit here.
You can experiment with it, but generally, I've had that sometimes, and generally, when I have that, I swallow.
I think it's I can attach something horrible to it. If I don't swallow, you know, then just fall over and I'm just going to croak. That part's kind of interesting, the panic.
Yeah. I've known people who've had issues around saliva, producing a lot of it or whatever. And sometimes just different people, different states. I mean, I've gone through periods where I do a lot of that. And occasionally, I met a couple of people over the years I've been teaching. They talked about it, and at some point, it was suddenly this revelation that it related to some kind of trauma they had as a child that was causing them to kind of. I think one person was almost drowned or something, and so the idea of I don't know how that connected with saliva, but anyway, the person saw a connection But generally, with saliva and swallowing, you know, the urge can be quite strong. It can be interesting to hang out with it and develop some, not you know, as an exercise. But I generally just swallowing, mindfully. Yeah.
I know a thing. Maybe I'll bring it to you sometime after you did it. It's something that COVID wrote about swallowing, where you say don't
swallow.
You talked about how not to.
Great. So there's Yeah.
I was having a saliva experience. as soon as you said don't move, my mouth just filled with saliva, and I thought okay, I'm just gonna see what happens, and it sort of the faucet turned off at some point, and it was just I wasn't gaining anymore. And I wasn't choking, I wasn't drowning. I just had a mouthful of saliva, but it wasn't bad.
Great. Yes, sir.
After several minutes, my leg began moving like a
and stop. I wasn't doing it.
Yeah, that's fine. There's no intention behind that then.
No. It just happened like maybe three times.
Yeah.
And I just noticed it. That's all.
Right, right. For this exercise, you're welcome to spasm. Yes?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I really loved it. I love the really strong structure of not being able to move, just the imperative of not moving, and within that, trying to catch my mind before it shifted into a thought. So.
Great. Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Yes.
I often have an experience when I'm meditating of moving and kind of realizing that I was distracted by the fact that I just scratched my head. And so I think it was interesting to me to stay focused and work on that more through the whole time. And to also see the parallel with jumping into a thought and moving time, which I hadn't really seen that the parallel of the feelings before. But for the body movement, I can stay focused and see the desire to move arise. But for the mind movements, I just kind of jump into a thought without seeing the desire to move.
Right.
And then I can come back out of the thought. And if it's a really strong thought, then I can feel the desire to go back to it.
Uh-huh.
Kind of play with that. But I can't see the desire to move before the thought comes.
Uh-huh. I think that comes with greater subtlety of meditation, as the mind gets more concentrated. There might be some day you can see that. One of the fascinating things to do with thoughts, when the mind is very... I'll say it in the way I experienced it, because everyone has a little different kind of image, maybe how or description. But when the mind gets very, very concentrated, very still, you can feel the arising of a thought. And I experience it kind of like a bubble arising out of nothing or something's bubbles kind of surfacing. And if I'm right there to catch that bubble as it begins to rise, and there's no interest, no involvement, just kind of seeing it clearly, that energy, that impulse to think is there, it just dissolves. And what's fascinating is that I never know what that thought was going to be. It's like this, the urge to think precedes the actual vocalization or sub-vocalization of that thought. It's like first there's this impulse, and this kind of this pressure kind of coming up about this thought's about to happen. And but the mind has to be very, very still in order to see that. Yeah.
Do you feel that in the body?
For that, for me, I'm not sure what to say about that. I certainly associated with the body, with being in the body, that experience of that bubble.
There's some sensation, right?
What?
There's some sensation.
A little bit of pressure.
Yeah, it's somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Have you ever had the experience, that experience, when you have a lot of energy and you're extremely agitated and your mind wants to think a lot? And you get to that place where you see that, I guess the best way to describe it is a puzzle. It's sort of this gray thing, and you see it and it goes away, and it's immediately replaced by another one, and then there's this kind of boiling on your mind that you don't think about anything up in there.
Not sure what you're saying. You're saying your mind is agitated, but...
There's lots of thoughts that want to come, I guess. And they're, so you see one, and it doesn't come. And then there's another one immediately. And it's this like boiling little bubbles. That you, none of them are really thoughts, because you see them coming, and they don't come.
I don't know. I'm not sure I've had that experience. Maybe something similar, but... I mean, certainly I've been, sat down and been phenomenally agitated, and the mind just kind of like this crazy monkey, is kind of speeding all over the place, and it's happening so fast that I can't really track what I'm thinking. Just kind of these little explosions of stuff. But But let's go back to this thing about the exercise, if we can.
Yeah, I have one question about this. I'm just saying that I've watched for years this standard operational procedure. I'll be sitting there, and I've been told or decide that I don't want to do something bad. Like, I want to sit very still, so I'm holding myself very still. And I get to this place where I realize that this is extremely subtle. It's not like a clenched jaw or anything like that. This extreme subtle tightness in muscles in the very, very back of my jaw. Just this little twinge of tightness. And so is it, nothing's moving, but one of the things that I do is I just let that go and those muscles relax. Is that doing something?
That's doing something. That's doing something. So for this exercise, you wouldn't do that. You simply feel the impulse to do that. But, you know, it's a fine thing to do. I mean, there's nothing wrong doing that. Just for this exercise, that wouldn't have been the assignment. The assignment here is just get to know the intention. And then as you do this, you get a lot of power over yourself if you can see your intention clearly. And then you can choose whether to follow that intention or not. If you don't see the intention and the intention's kind of in charge and you operate automatically, there's no freedom there. And even something that's healthy, like for example, relaxing some tension, can be done automatically. And there's no freedom there. But if you can see clearly the arising of that intention that's there, then you can decide, well, is this a wise thing to do right now? So part of this exploration of intention, desire, is also kind of the other side of it is to learning how to let go. There are times when, you know, it's appropriate to follow through an intention, but a very important element of mindfulness practice, spiritual Buddhist practice, is also the learning to let go of intentions, of desires, of impulses. And, you know, so can you let go? Can you see it? Can an intention arise for something? Can you see it clearly for what it is? And can you let go of it and not act on it? Is that possible? So when I was sitting here at the end, you know, I rang the bell once and I closed my eyes because I was going to do the same thing as you, right? And pay attention to my eyes, you know, my impulse to open my eyes. And the impulse to open my eyes was there immediately again. And I just was there feeling it. And very quickly it went away. And then I said, well, I wonder when I'm going to open my eyes now, because, you know, there was no more desire to open them. And but then I remember that I was teaching the class, and maybe it'd be useful for me to kind of look around a little bit and get some sense of what the class is happening in the class, and so then that seemed like a useful thing. So then the intention to open my eyes came back, and then the second time I decided to act on it because it seemed like, you know, it was my job to be tracking more what's going on. So. So remember what I said, that this issue of intention usually happens later on a retreat, after a person's somewhat stable, settled in their practice. I say that so that as you do the homework for the next week, if you find yourself getting agitated by paying attention to intention, maybe then you want to let go of it. Maybe it's not appropriate. Or maybe try to find a simpler way of doing it. The one of the guidelines for how you do this practice is whatever tool you're using, is it in the service of you getting more peaceful, less conflicted, more kind of mindful, more concentrated as you go here? If it's been taking you in the opposite direction, then maybe either stop doing that particular tool or see if you can adjust how you use that tool so it serves that purpose. So intentions. It's very helpful in daily life, too, to notice your intentions before you act. So other questions or comments about this? Yes, Karen.
When I started, I was very, very tired. And so I kind of doubled my effort. And I thought, okay, I'm really going to have a strong intention not to move, to stay with my breath. And I really got an incredible surge of energy and was able to get very concentrated very quickly, whereas normally when I sit and meditate, I sort of take my merry time getting concentrated. And there's a kind of predictable rhythm. So I guess my question is more about the initial application of intention and then sustaining intention in practice, which is, I know, a little different than the exercise.
Right. So, but what's the question?
Well, I had a really strong intention for this short period,
right,
this little exercise. And so I guess I'm asking how to generate that more. I find it hard to keep my intention strong.
So you can probably do it when you first sit down. Sit down, generate a strong intention. But then the question is how to sustain a strong resolve, a strong determination as you go along with practice. That's a very good question. One of the interesting things, like with, so there are times when it's helpful to, if you sit down to meditate or do walking meditation, say, I'm going to be as mindful as I can, really resolved the whole time. It's a setup for, you know, failure sometimes. But rather, if you do it in small chunks, I'm really committed to this next breath. I'm going to be there for this breath. And you get to the end of that breath and you recommit. Or you do walking meditation, the one pass of your walking path. Okay, I'm going to really be there for that, you know, that pass. And then when I turn around, I'll make the commitment to really be there again for the next pass. So sometimes doing it in short chunks can be helpful.
Really consciously renewing it all through the sitting.
Right. That's one way. The other way for me has been intention or resolve is kind of like a muscle. Sometimes I'll sit down and try to sit with great resolve, very intent, and so I'm kind of exercising that muscle of being consciously intentful as I go along in the practice. And my experience has been that muscle gets stronger over time. The motivation, you know, it helps a lot to stay so much close in touch with your motivation to practice, feeling its value and how important it is. In Zen, they have these wonderful little chants they do regularly, or say, or things they write. One of them is they say, "Life and death is the great matter. Life and death is the great matter. Practice as if your hair is on fire. Don't waste time." It's written across the wooden plaque that they use to wooden sounding board that call people to the meditation hall. And so the idea is that as that little saying is being hit, and it's supposed to be travel out across the sound, across the monastery when they're calling you to the meditation hall. Don't waste time. And so there's a whole exercises people do, reflections people can do to try to get their resolve strengthened. There are times in our life when, for example, we encountered death. And we come back from that kind of situation saying, well, okay, I'm really serious about my practice now. None of this kind of dallying about and kind of easy come, easy go. I'm going to sit here with great resolve. And other things, you know, that can really kind of put a little bit of fire under us. So sometimes, you know, some reflection or rereading or, you know, something can, some reminder of how important it is to how practice is so important, can give some fuel so the intention is sustainable longer through the sitting. Things like that come to my mind. But I would encourage you to experiment for a while, sitting with greater intent, resolve, determination, resolve. I like the word resolve a lot. Because resolve, in my mind, is something, for me, and maybe it's just something peculiar with me, resolve in my mind is something I do with my whole body. And it kind of, almost like, it's not tense, be resolved. I don't feel there's, to me, it's a whole bodily involvement with something, but it's not tense. Whereas intention, to me, it has a little more mental quality to it. So, yes. Last two, and then we'll... Yeah.
I really liked it, and I felt like I didn't know if I was moving or not. I was with my breath, and I felt like, I think I'm moving, but I think I felt like it was like a very subtle wave. Like my whole body was sort of going a little like this, but I thought, no, I'm not moving. And I couldn't tell if I was moving or not. And then I really liked focusing on the intention of opening up my eyes. That's the desire. Yeah, I like that.
It's pretty common for people to have some experience of swaying or some oscillation or some pulsing in the body. Maybe connected sometimes to the heartbeat or other kind of pulsing or oscillating things going on in the body. And if you're very still, sometimes you can feel that. And there's no, you know, just kind of generally just kind of natural thing going on, natural phenomenon. It's fine. The thing about taking the end of the sitting and being very intent. Mindful of the process of ending the sitting is that many of us, you hear the bell at the end of a sitting, it's just like mindfulness goes out the window with the bell. And it's kind of a pity, you know, and it doesn't have to go out the window, the practice can continue. And so one of the ways to do that is to open your eyes intentionally and be intentful of how you move your body and how you start your day and how you make your coffee, and off you go. Lorraine? You had a question?
It's opposite
a
little bit, that you talked a lot about walking meditation.
Yeah.
Can that be a regular part of practice?
Oh, yeah.
Instead of?
Sure. Walking meditation is as significant as sitting meditation.
Can you talk a little bit about how to go about that?
Very briefly, generally you would find a walkway that's about 30 feet long, and you would walk back and forth. And whereas sitting meditation, we tend to use the breath as kind of the anchor for the practice, and the alternating sensations of breathing in and out. For walking meditation, we use the alternating sensations of the feet and lower legs stepping as the ground or the anchor of the practice. And the mind wanders away, and you bring the attention back to the sensation in your legs. And slowly with time, develop some stability, concentration on the sensations of your breath, being mindful of what they are.
Can you go along the path?
Just... You can. There's many ways. Of course you can. The advantage of walking back and forth in a very simple environment, someplace where there's not a lot of distractions to pull your eyes away, is that if you wander around longer, then part of your mind, it's a very subtle part of your mind, is negotiating the path. And so but if you walk back and forth, pretty quickly you know the path. And so that part of your mind can be put to rest. So, very, very simply, then. I mean, there's a lot I can say about walking meditation. And I probably have given a talk, a Thursday talk sometime, on walking meditation. I don't know if it's in the tape library or anywhere. But. And it's time. So there's homework. So the agreement, if you remember, the first day of the class... was that even though the coming to class part of the class ends, the agreement was that you would sit for the week with the homework, you know, 45 minutes for the week continuing after the last class session, because that's the way it works, right? Right? So you're on your own. It's the honor system now. And disadvantage is there isn't the kind of follow-up the following week as we have had here. And I want to underscore what I've said already, that the practice of meditation, mindfulness meditation, can be done in many different ways. And you know, find some teachers who say this is the way or the only way or whatever. But there's many different ways, different styles of doing it, many different tools we're using how to do it. Some are more active, some are more receptive and passive. Some involve not just clear seeing by itself, just seeing how things are. And some are more engaged and directive. And you're gonna have as if you know as serious meditators, you're going to have to sooner or later find your way, your own way in negotiating this and finding what's appropriate at different times. What you'll probably find is that different tools are useful at different stages of your meditation. So even just like the things you've been taught in this class here, it might be that for a year or something, that some of the things you learned here is not they're not very relevant, don't really apply that much. But then later, you say, you know, in a year, your mind, your concentration is strong enough, or you've entered a different level of meditation. Oh, looking at intention. If I look at the intentions now, I can see how paying more attention to my intention will help to continue to foster greater concentration. Or the exercise we did the first week of looking at some of the different mental states that come into play with meditation. It might be useful now, but it might be really useful in 2-3 months if you're on retreat, for example. You see how that kind of helps push your cutting edge. What's the appropriate way of practicing mindfulness is partly dependent on the person you are, your characteristic, how your mind works. It's also dependent on what's happening in your life and then also what's happening in your meditation. So when you're going into deeper states of meditation, different instructions can be sometimes appropriate. So I apologize. I feel a little bit apologetic to give you so much. But I think it's part of the beauty of human life is to be engaged, you know, in the whole diversity, the wide variety and diversity of who we are as human beings, and to include it all as part of the show. And my simplest wish for this little series is that you would feel that you could be a little bit more engaged in your meditation practice than you have in the past. And in being more engaged, that actually helps you be more concentrated in doing it. That's very simple. That's very, you know, very, you know, so you're not so likely to get carried away by your stories because you find the process of meditation, what's happening in the present, to be compelling or interesting. So you're engaged and involved. So the homework is there. The class is not over for you. And I very much appreciate you coming and very grateful that you came and you're so engaged. And until next time, thank you.